Psalm 125, a song of ascents. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forevermore. For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good, and to those who are upright in their hearts. But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord lead away with evildoers. Peace be upon Israel. So as we come back into our Psalms of Ascent, this Song of Ascents, we are joining us in this sixth song in this triannual, three times a year pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So along this journey, the travelers at this point will behold the first glimpse of the city of Jerusalem. You might recall earlier where the psalmist would write, "My eye looked to the hills." Well, now, the traveler would observe very closely would be mountains. If you can capture this image in your mind, mountains easily convey awe and majesty. That's why you look on calendars. That's why you look on postcards. That's why your screensaver or your background on your computer, your phone, frequently will have a picture of mountains. And if you have the opportunity to participate in our Bible study when we're outside, you get some of the elements of the majesty of the hills. Not really quite a mountain, but a bit of elevation. Spring Mount is also the same. Our token hills that are nearby, small elements of majesty. But if you were to take and just hop on the turnpike, run up the Blue Route, far enough, you get into the Poconos, or if you really like to travel, you go with Dan and Rob, you go up to New England, you see real mountains. If you really had the choice, you get on a plane, you go out to the Rockies, you see the majesty of the mountains. And yet in the rocky land of Israel, the traveler coming for the feast days beholds the majesty of Mount Zion and the surrounding mounts, the Mount of Olives, Mount Scopus. How majestic. Coupled with and more focused on in this psalm is the idea of surrounded. We'll spend some time looking at how Jerusalem on Mount Zion is surrounded. And even mention just the defensive posture of this a little bit. And yet this traveler was not really to be impressed by the defensive creation structure, but to connect these mountains with the covenant God of Israel, and that Yahweh is surrounding his people. The traveler at this point in his journey would sing Psalm 125 and find that as God surrounds his people, the traveler should confide in his God. So I want to invite you today to come with us on this journey, to confide in our God. And Psalm 125 is going to show us four glimpses behind the scenes into the workings of God for his people, why we should confide in our God. So as we look at the text, as we begin, the first glimpse we're going to observe is that protection leads to stability. And so obviously, as you're traveling to festivals, these Jews are going to notice mountains. Have you ever been hiking up a mountain and not noticed it? It is physically impossible. You cannot miss a mountain as you ascend one, even if you are ascending the same one several times a year, year after year, for your entire life. You will notice the mountain. And yet at the very beginning of this song, the psalmist calls these travelers, these mountain defenders, to rest. What's interesting is one of the scholars I was following as I was preparing for this made some pretty obvious observations, but I want to re-list them. Number one is that these travelers were not just to give most of their trust, but all of their known capable trust. And I want to clarify this a little bit with the second statement, which is not ultimate trust, not that your trust must be this high to get on the mountain. All of the trust that you have should be turned away from things, jobs, people, items, houses, whatever, and turned towards the Lord. And so the travelers were to turn their confidence, their trust from all other avenues, and to place their trust, their confidence in Yahweh, in the Lord. And we'll see that faith in God's protection grants strength. The psalmist writes, like Mount Zion, the truster is unable to be moved. The person who trusts is resilient. It's like external forces bounce off, or if you've ever seen those videos of landslides, you see all of this rock and this mud and stuff fall off the mountain, and then when you look back up the mountain is still there. The psalmist says those that put their trust, their confidence in God, are unmoved. And we're reminded that mountains don't just appear and disappear. As a matter of fact, when building the Transcontinental Railroad out west, the rail companies did not just use pickaxes and shovels. The companies relied on black powder. They needed to move the mountains, but could not easily. In working on the highest points of the Sierra Nevada, the companies ran into a massive problem: granite. Granite slowed them down significantly. The rail companies needed something more than black powder, and that was when James Howden comes on the scene to make on-site nitroglycerin. It's recorded that he made up to 100 pounds of nitroglycerin a day. The construction teams were able to increase their progress from 1.18 feet a day to almost double that, 1.82 feet per day. That doesn't seem like much, but you try digging in granite. A mountain is not easily moved. Those that trust in the Lord, like Mount Zion, are not easily moved. Matter of fact, the psalm says, cannot be moved. What's interesting is if we push ahead a little bit into the New Testament, Paul, as he's writing to the Ephesians, will make a statement that stands parallel. He starts talking about the armor of God. And he talks about how the believers need to do something. He commands them to stand. And he reminds them it's not from our own fortitude, but it is in the strength of God. And so Paul agrees. He might even be thinking back to the psalm. Those who trust in the Lord cannot be moved. And what's interesting is it's not just about strength, about this immovability. But it says, it continues on, but this person abides forever. And so the idea of abide is more of dwelling. And so in Hebrew studies, when we're in seminary, it talks about the different uses of abide. It can refer in context to short term. It can talk about temporary but longish term, or it can talk about permanent. And so thankfully, with the clues in the text saying abides forever, we understand this is dwelling, this is residing, this is remaining there. We're reminded, we see in Abraham and Lot in Genesis 13, they were struggling to reside in the same place. Same word. So Lot chose to abide in Sodom. But it communicates forever. The psalmist gives us the surprising and yet not surprising time frame. This qualifies this imagery. Forever colors this resting permanently. And so thus abide, dwell, remain are the pictures we can associate. You know, in case you didn't catch the permanent endurance of Mount Zion, which to this day is still around, and even under the great amount of war that has been fought there, the mountain is still there. I took a little bit of time hoping, not expecting, but hoping that I could find someone who took drone video footage or took video shots, even from a helicopter, kind of approaching up the mountain to just replay what that looks like. You get a lot of mountaintop, a lot of the city of Jerusalem as it's expanded. Mount Zion is still the same, so much so that the ruins of previous generations of cities are the foundation on Mount Zion. The city that is Jerusalem today is built on the rubble, on the mountain that is still there from when the travelers would recite Psalm 125 on the way to the festivals in Jerusalem. And so, those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. And we're reminded further that faith in God's protection is not a one-time event. This is not a, it's good for today because it's Sunday, but Monday morning, best of luck to you. Sometimes I almost wonder if we under-describe God. Sometimes I wonder if we say, well, God is good, and God will take care of me this time, but I'm not so sure about next time. No, the psalm is encouraging us to refine our faith, our trust in Him, and to truly understand, to truly think and believe and realize that our trust in God is not temporary. And yet it brings up a point, because how are people going to know that you have strength, that you have endurance, if you have faith in God, if strong winds don't come, if big storms don't happen? Sometimes you've heard the phrase, talk is cheap. And until the testing of the faith, of your faith happens, your trust in God is cheap. You yourself don't even know how much God can do to protect. These attacks might be scary. These attacks might seek to label us as speed bumps rather than little mountains surrounded by the big mountain of God. And so that if you think it's a once and done with your trust in God, You might think that you have to white knuckle, hold on so tight during these times. But what the psalmist is calling us to is a confident, continual, ever-growing trust in our God. You don't abide forever if you pull the ripcord. You don't continue if you say, you know what? I'm out. This is a lifelong call. This is a big deal. This is a call to trust again in your God. And what's interesting here is I totally forgot to mention verse 2. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people. From this time forth and forevermore. And so the pictures continue. First glimpse, as you're walking the Jerusalem as a traveler, you're on your way to celebrate in Jerusalem, whichever festival it is, whichever feast it is, and you see Jerusalem. And you see it's surrounded by mountains. And we've talked about the call to trust in God, to confide in God. And we're given a picture here that we have to imagine in our minds because we're not making this journey. But this is a journey that these travelers would become something that is just monotonous. They have to slog up the mountain and they're going to see the mountain. But the psalm calls them back to not take for granted that they are seeing mountains surrounding, mountains protecting Jerusalem. So the psalmist says, so is our God. So is Yahweh. So is the Lord. And just like that person who trusts will abide forever, we're reminded that God, the Lord, is doing so forevermore. Not only does God invite us to confide in him because of his protection, but he also gives us a second glimpse. And so we're going to jump ahead a little bit, if you'll hold with me for a moment. So we're going to skip past verse 3 and move on to verses 4 and 5. Verse 4 says, do good, O Lord, to those who are good, and to those who are upright in their hearts. But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away with evildoers. Peace be upon Israel. As rusty as I am in Hebrew, and as improficient as I am, if that's even a good word, when I started looking at this, I was fascinated because you look at this in the Hebrew and you have the Lord, right? Verse 4 says, do good, O Lord. So in the middle of it, you have the Lord, who's the subject. And then you have, on the first part, you have the verb. And on the other side, you have who does good to those. And so in the Hebrew, it looks at Tov, Yahweh, Tov. And I bring this up, and I wouldn't do this because normally I'd be too terrified to do this and a Hebrew scholar would come up and plow me over. But because we're just got done talking about how the hills, the mountains surround Jerusalem, it seems that we lose a little in the English, and it does seem to be that God is showing he's surrounded by his goodness. And so as we look at verse 4, the verb do good, the object to those who are good, seems to be a reminder that God is the source of goodness and that he's not stingy with his goodness. Again, if a leading scholar were to get up and say, you're completely wrong, I would take my beating and go sit down. But the first impression I get is how God is surrounded by goodness. And so we're reminded that goodness must come from God. And that trusters of God, even in the bad times, can hope and call upon this God who does good. The uprightness of trusters of God is visible to others around and is obvious to God. And then we're going to come down to the end. We're going to see, but the peace of God that we crave so desperately, we experience in faith, but not in totality. So this through this whole psalm, we were reminded that God is identified as the Lord, as Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God of Israel. And so this idea keeps in line with Old Testament understanding that obedience to God brings life, as Deuteronomy reminded us, calls us out to. But disobedience brings curse. So for the Israelite, observing these majestic mountains that surround Jerusalem, he or she would be inclined to trust that God, that he would do good upon them who have the status of good. And thankfully, the psalmist clarifies further that because of the status, many believers themselves to be good and have fooled themselves. The psalm also clarifies the good are upright in heart. These are the ones that are going to offer sacrifices to God, that are reminded that their relationship to God is a big deal. They were the ones seeking God to take away their sins that God himself deems righteous. And so hopefully, as that thought is meditating, it would give them further impetus, further impulse to continue this journey of slogging, to continue to pursue and offer sacrifices again. And yet, as we look here in 21st century, there's an amazing contrast, an amazing and humbling realization on this side of the cross is how God plans before the foundation of the world to not just do good to those who are good, but while we were yet sinners, Christ did good for the ungodly. As people of God, we should have confidence. We should trust in God as we behold his surrounding protection and his righteous goodness. Now let's take a moment to understand we should confide in God as we glimpse at judgment that eliminates disobedience. We're going to go back to verse 3. Verse 3 begins right away with an explanation of the longevity of God surrounding his people. Or verse 2, and then verse 3 actually contrasts that. Before we can dive into this scepter of wickedness, I want to talk a little bit about that, because if you spend time reading other translations, the King James refers to the scepter of wickedness as the rod. We have the scepter of wickedness in the ESV. Eugene Peterson, as he was overseeing the message, wrote the fist of the wicked. And so as we come to this text, it would be obvious for us to say, oh, well, this is talking about rulers. But it may not be. It might be talking in larger quantity just the influence of the wicked. And so as we look at this, there's a big deal here. You see, God does not allow wickedness to remain. In contrasting, those who trust in the Lord abide forever. Verse 3 says The scepter of the righteousness shall not rest on the land. And so we're given a glimpse of hope, a glimpse, a reminder of the temporary nature of wickedness. And we're reminded that God does not want, he does not allow the wicked to remain in the land for long. For long. Because he is aware of the negative impacts the wicked have upon the righteous. The righteous will be vexed, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. So God is looking out for his people like he is surrounding them. His people need to have the proper view of God protecting, guarding, and the proper view of time as God works. You see, his people must trust that his judgment will remove the disobedient. We're reminded the wicked are temporary. They will not rest, as opposed to the righteous who will abide. They're not even there long enough to get their junk mail, is the picture. And so the permanent view of the land reminds us that the wicked will not rest on the land, so the land will outlast the wicked in the very least. You see, this land that's allotted to the righteous conveys this long-term view. It reflects that God did not make a random decision, but it was intentional. The land allotted identifies that the people of Israel were able to select their land based on casting of lots. The idea of God using objects to identify this goes to you, and this goes to you, and this goes to you. Should indicate a serious nature of the portions that Israel received from God. God seemed to assign worth upon them in order to assign portions and remove the wicked. Between the reality of the trusters of being stable in verses 1 and 2, and due to God's protection surrounding the people of God, the temporary nature of the wicked in verses 3 down really through verse 5, you and I, we should be compelled to trust God. We should be thinking more in terms of God's length of time, reminding that God is patient by our standards, being reminded that God does resolve, and he does so in ways that are beyond our expectations. Because it says down in verse 5, those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away. Verse 3 does tell us that one of the ways in which the stability of the believer is tested is when the wicked have the priority, the upper hand over the believer. When truth is suppressed and evil is taught as fact, then it's easy to doubt God, be dismissive of his people. The psalmist wants us to remember during the scary times what was just penned a few words before, that Yahweh surrounds his people as the big mountains surround Jerusalem. So when wickedness is so great that the righteous are tempted to do wrong, the righteous must recognize confidence in their God on the depths of faith that hopefully they've been exercising. And at that point, the righteous should understand the value and the security in trusting God as their protector, as the one who truly is surrounding in goodness to give to the upright. That is when the world will identify God's people as immovable, as forever abiding. One of the Old Testament scholars, Derek Kidner, made a profound statement as we're talking about wickedness a little bit. And so as he comments about the scepter of righteousness, he says, this may or may not point to foreign domination. The heathen have no monopoly on sin. Kinder reminds us that Israel had been beset with both evil from the outside as well as their share of evil leaders from inside. For when the people of God forsake God, they find themselves bearing the curses of Deuteronomy. And yet, we're reminded that not only are the wicked temporary, but because they're contrary to God, God is dealing with them. God is aware of the negative impact upon the righteous if he does not act. If he does not deal with this scepter of wickedness, the righteous would stretch out their hands to do wrong. It continues on, and it says, but those who turn aside to their crooked ways, those that choose, they choose to follow paths that they seemingly bent themselves. The psalmist reminds, the Lord will lead away these people with the evildoers. Verse 5 clearly reminds us the deceivers, the crooked path choosers, and the doers of evil will not be as in charge of themselves as they thought. They will follow God, moving them away from the land God has given his people. Ultimately, the wicked will be in opposition to the sovereignty of God, to the kingship of God. And thus, the potential for evil kingship is very real. And yet, peace cannot occur until God has acted. And so, those that trust in the Lord, up in verse 1, seem to be able to recognize the wickedness, the evil influence, the oppression of disobedience, and come down to the end and recognize in confidence and sing in a prayer, peace be upon Israel. Shalom, that calmness that creation craves is not yet, but it is coming. We cannot bring peace to fruition. God must act. We come back to that need to continue to trust in God, to confide in our God, to be secure in his protection. Because when injustice happens, we're inclined to desire to right the wrong. I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm not interested in speaking truth and being the lone voice standing in the wind. Sometimes I want to be the avenger of God, the righter of wrongs. The scorekeeper who gets to say, see, as if God's called me to judge and perform evaluation of the wicked. We're reminded our job is not to overthrow the king of Babylon, but to be confident in our God and to stand up to that king and say, O king, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Our obligation is to wait for God to work, to be patient and not work before God. Our patience ought to highlight confidence in God as our protector, as he is his avenger of himself. And when we align with him, he is our avenger. His way is right, and he is the one that is keeping careful record of all evil being done, even in secret. God's judgment eliminates disobedience at the appointed time. We can trust in God to deal with wickedness. We can abide in his protection and rely on his righteousness because God is very aware of the wrong, and he will deal with it so that the righteous does not stretch out their hands to disobey. I want to give you the fourth glimpse now. And this one seems to be very much an observation. And this one is that accessibility invites frequency. You see, early on we talked about how God surrounds his people, just like the mountains surround Jerusalem. And this picture very quickly becomes a defensive picture, a picture of God surrounding, a God putting out his thick skin to cover his tender people. But it seems like we might just want to draw on another psalm. You see, in Psalm 1, we're given the picture of stability as a tree. The one who meditates on God's word all the time is like a tree planted by rivers of blessing and are more stable than the ungodly who are unstable as chaff. And if we think about verse 1, those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion. I'm hoping you're starting to see that God is very accessible. He surrounds his people. He is available to his people. We're reminded that God is also trustworthy. We've had the chance to reflect on how, as part of God's protection, he has a countdown timer on the wicked. Those bending God's way, those doing evil, will not abide forever. But those that trust in the Lord, the immovable ones. The majesty of the mountains that we've talked about earlier on would be very impressive that first time. It might still be awe-inspiring the second time. The third time, I don't know about you, but I would start to have that monotony in the journey. I would start to be like, I've got the mountain to climb. It's hot out here in the rocks. Let's just get to Jerusalem. Let's do the worship. Let's do the sacrifices, and let's go. The dumb mountain is still in our way. And we're reminded that these mountains aren't going anywhere. I mean, the text says, from this time forth and forevermore, the mountains would be potential for obnoxious hindrance. But God is still surrounding his people. God, who we don't see right there, we don't have the image of God surrounding his people. We have the image of the mountain, mountains surrounding Jerusalem. So these realities leave me with a question, an invitation, really. If the upright of God, if those that are his followers are called to trust God, and God is surrounding these people forever, driving the wicked out in a timely fashion, this God that is good, surrounded by the good that he dispenses, should we not feel invited to go to him? If God is really that close, if God is really surrounding his people like the mountains, should those that trust in him, that are making these travels, that are living the life, that are following the path of his follower, do we look like we believe God is there? Do we look like God is available to us? several of the pastors as I was studying through this commented on how we like the idea of God as our emotional safety. We like him to be bigger than our emotional support, whatever. But we want to use him as a utility is kind of the danger that's made present. We want to take advantage of God and his protection, but then we want to live our own life. And so if God is surrounding us, if God is protecting us, if he is dealing with the wicked, leading them away, then hopefully there should be an obvious desire to say, there's nothing stopping me from going to him again. So I want to suggest that this psalm invites us to practice God's presence and to seek his face more frequently than maybe we do. The psalm winds down in a prayer of faith. As the traveler is confident that God is working, the same traveler has been invited to confide his faith in Yahweh. A traveler who's experienced the difficulties that coincide with other psalms understands that while wickedness is short-lived, God's timeline is different. It's different than our timeline. And that even short-lived evil can feel like long-term evil. So to keep trusting God when life throws physical aches, pains, that can be hard. To keep trusting God when you are betrayed by a partner, especially if it's a believer, may take your truster muscles and make them weak. It's hard to trust. It's hard to trust when you act in goodwill to another person and that person maligns you, rips you apart. It's hard to trust when politics seem to pile up obstacles and the way you do life is not as straightforward as before, or even going out and trying to be wise stewards of your resources. It just doesn't work well. You know, when obedience will cost a reputation, it seems hard to trust. It's at this exact time that we need to find again just how close God is when he surrounds his people forevermore. We should confide in God. Psalm 125 focuses on the mountains surrounding Jerusalem, surrounding Mount Zion. It would be utterly surprising for the singer to come to a festival and to labor up the mountain in one trip and then the next trip come to the festival and not find the mountain there. This is not even something that we would take very seriously. We expect the mountains to be there. We see the protective nature. We recognize that this naturally captures God and how he relates to his people, how he watches over them and removes the dangerous elements in the proper time. So the psalmist ends his song with a faith-filled prayer. Peace upon Israel. The travelers were encouraged to keep their full trust in God. And by the end of the psalm, they should be singing this prayer of trust for God to bring peace upon the land allotted to the righteous. As we finish up Psalm 125, we should be compelled to find our confidence in this same God, not in our wealth, not in our wisdom, not our health, not our abilities, not our network, not our friends. We should confide in God. Let's pray.